Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 8, where we will be talking with Dr. Beth Sutton Ramspeck about Dirt and the Dark Arts, Tackling Taboos in Harry Potter. Thanks for joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Today I am joined, as usual, by our resident expert, John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and the author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. John is also teaching a Harry Potter class at the University of Central Oklahoma this semester. And John, I'm just curious, what are you talking about with your class these days?
Wow, this week it was Prisoner of Azkaban. And that sort of rolls right into today's subject. What I'm excited about is we're talking about the seven keys to Harry Potter that I talk about in my online course, Wizard Reading Formula, and we're gonna be looking at Cursed Child to see if Rowling actually was a major participant in it. We're gonna take what we know about how Rowling writes from her one screenplay and her Cormoran Strike novels and Casual Vacancy and Harry Potter, and we're gonna use those tools to look at Cursed Child and see how much of it really is a Rowling work. It's kind of exciting here to do that.
That's what I'm up to. That's great. And I know that you are going to be offering your Wizard Reading Formula online class coming up here. So our listeners should be aware that might be available to them pretty soon.
Oh, yeah. We'll have an announcement at MuggleNet and do the whole thing.
That's great. Well, today our special guest is Dr. Beth Sutton Ramspeck, Associate Professor of English at The Ohio State University at Lima. She specializes in Victorian literature and women's studies, and she's the author of the book Raising the Dust, The Literary Housekeeping of Mary Ward, Sarah Grand, and Charlotte Perkins Gilman. I think probably along with a lot of our listeners, I have vivid memories of the yellow wallpaper. That is a story that sticks with you. Although Dr. Sutton Ramspeck writes and teaches about Victorian British Lit, she has also turned her attention to the Harry Potter books. In addition to a course on Harry Potter, she has written two chapters that appeared in the book The Ravenclaw Chronicles. She's got a chapter about the ambivalent portrayal of creativity in Harry Potter, as well as domination, autonomy, and character in Harry Potter. And she's also working on a study of dirt and cleanliness in the Harry Potter series. She shared with us a conference presentation, The Dirt on Dirt in the Harry Potter series, and is working on another one about cleanliness that will involve the house elves, which I am super excited to hear more about. Of course, the house elves, I love them. And these studies, all of the things she's doing, have a kind of common theme that fit into a new book that she's going to be writing on our favorite topic of Harry Potter called Mischief Managed, Rule Breaking in the Harry Potter Series. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here. I feel honored.
That's great.
I want to jump in right away and say that I've been hearing about Beth Sutton Ramspeck for more than a year now from friend of this show, Emily Strand, and how much she loves your stuff. And frankly, anything that Emily recommends, I look at seriously, even though Emily and I disagree on everything. That's why we're such good friends. And sure enough, reading your stuff, seriously, having read your stuff, Beth, I understand exactly what Emily was excited about, that this is really the new wave of Potter scholarship that is really taking We're moving beyond really the superficial stuff, the level of complexity that you confront inside these essays is really important. work, and I can't wait to talk to you about it.
Right, and I think that Emily had seen your presentation on dirt in the Harry Potter series, and it's one of those things where you think, is there much to say about that? And then you hear what you have to say, and it's like, oh my gosh, that's so important.
Well, thank you. I was very impressed by Emily's presentation too, I have to say, and I'm a huge fan of both of your work. So I am just I'm blown away by the nice things you're saying. Thank you so much.
It's so fun to meet other people who are working on it and similarly inspired. So that's great. So today we are going to talk about Beth's approach to the Harry Potter books, related to the topic of rule breaking in general, but also related to taboos, I think is kind of a theme that comes through. Breaking taboos, but also maybe sometimes when you shouldn't break a taboos that might be reasonable. And so we're going to be studying questions today of purity and transgression. And so listeners, come along with us as we roll up our sleeves and examine dirt, unforgivable curses, creativity, innovation, all those kinds of things. So before we get too far into all of that great complexity and detail that John was mentioning, Beth, share with us a little bit how you initially encountered the Harry Potter books.
Well, my daughter was 8 years old when the first book came out, so she was the perfect age. And I heard from a friend about the books, and you know, I began to see things about them, and I thought, well, this is perfect. My daughter liked fantasy, so we would try the Harry Potter series. I got the book for her. She started reading it, and she got a little hung up on the opening chapter. The Dursleys are not the most appealing characters, and the really good stuff starts later.
You know what? That happened with my son, too, and I just let him skip to the part where Hagrid tells him he's a wizard, and he went back later and read it. But the stuff with the Dursleys, he could not get into it, so I understand.
Yeah, it's tough. So I'd heard it was good and from reliable sources, and it seemed like something she would like. So I said, okay, well, I'll read it aloud to you. So I started reading it aloud to her, and I was totally hooked, and so was she. So we read the first book together, and then we read the second book together, and as they came out. And unfortunately, about the time the fourth book came out, she was hitting the preteen years and deciding that she was too cool. And so she left the whole thing behind. And she's a wonderful, wonderful young woman now.
But nevertheless.
But I didn't get over it. I was completely hooked. I'm a huge fan. And I was obsessed, like most Harry Potter fans are. And I remain so to this day.
Well, that's great. Now, I started as a fan too. And then there's some point at which you start to turn your scholarly interests toward this thing that you are like fanatically enjoying. So at what point, Beth, did you first decide that the Harry Potter series was worth putting your scholarly attention into?
Well, I have been teaching children's literature for a long time. So to a certain extent, I was open to the idea that a children's book could be studied in a serious way. That was not some kind of great revelation in general. And obviously, it's a very good one. And I was struck immediately, of course, by the wordplay, the sophistication, the use of Latin, and all of those things. So pretty much from the beginning, I took it seriously. It wouldn't have fit the courses in children's literature I was teaching because they were classics of children's literature. But then my department coordinator said, hey, how about if you teach a course in the Harry Potter class? And I was like, oh, of course, I'll do that. That's the solution. And so, I would say that I was taking them seriously from the very beginning. I didn't teach the class until the seventh book had come out. And I didn't write my first article until a couple of years after that, because I was interested in going to a conference and getting conference money. And so I racked my brain and, oh, okay, creativity. It was a conference that focused on creativity. And so how can I use it? Oh, okay, I won't write about Victorian literature. I'll write about the Harry Potter series and I'll write about creativity. And it worked out, and I went to another conference with the same paper, and then I wanted to go to another conference to take some of my students, basically, and wrote another paper. And having written two, it was like, oh, I could write about this. I could actually write a book. And it's, frankly, it's been a very long time since I had written any articles or papers. I got sort of blocked after I got tenure. That was such a strain to do that, and I thought I was dry and was just focusing on teaching. And then all of a sudden, Harry Potter rather magically opened me up and took care of the writer's block, and wow. I started having ideas.
Beth, I have to say, I had a very similar experience to yours, you know, and for me it was after the dissertation, and I didn't realize that I was burned out. But then finding scholarship in Harry Potter sort of, like you say, it sort of allowed my creativity to open up a little bit, and it's applying to other things now too. So it's so that's wonderful that the Harry Potter books can do that.
I'm laughing because, of course, I live in upside down land. I'm writing my dissertation after I've done all my books. Beth, I want to ask you though about your class real quickly, and maybe we'll cut this out, but because it's not on the sheet here. But I noticed that you're in your syllabus that you read the books as if your students are reading it for the first time. I've never seen a class mostly this. So if you haven't read the books, you can't start the class. You read the books through the semester. Is that because students no longer have read them all, or because that's the way you've always done it? Why did you do that?
Well, I guess I just sort of assumed that you would, you know, when you're studying something, you're reading it fresh. So some of that is just my idea of how you approach a text. You approach it, you know, consecutive chronologically, and you know, no matter what it is I'm teaching, I assume that I'm rereading it, and some of them might be rereading it. So it never, I guess it partly just didn't occur to me that we would do it any other way. When I first started teaching it, it was just as, well, the seventh book was still in hardback, and we read all the others in paper, but that one we had in hardback. And even then, I had a handful of students who'd never read the books. Mm. And since I've been teaching it, a larger and larger proportion of the students are reading it for the first time. I do have a number of older returning students who didn't grow up with it. And I'm finding that I have some students who've only seen the movies and are surprised by a lot of the things that are in the books that, of course, don't make it to the movies.
Right.
And always pleasantly surprised. And then I do have a handful of people who have pretty much kept it at arm's length and don't know very much about it at all. And so we have a rule. It's the international statute of secrecy that students are not allowed to give spoilers. And I divide the students up. Oh, yeah. I divide the students up into houses. And about the only way you can lose house points is by giving away a spoiler.
Oh, wow. That's great.
That's a wild. I mean, this week has been a big week, and this will be dated by the time this is released, but this week HBO is using experiential marketing to promote their Harry Potter films streaming on its network. And we just had the virtual reality Fantastic Beasts game released on the 23rd of January. And we're looking at very soon, I think it's next month in February, we'll get the first iterations of the Pokemon Go Hogwarts game, which promises to sweep the world. And I'm suspicious that we're going to move farther and farther away from the, or should I say further and further away from the books and a textual understanding of Harry Potter, and more into this movie experiential. It's going to be harder and harder to find people that have read the books and come to terms with them as they are.
But what you're suggesting is that people will have, they'll feel like they know Harry Potter because they've watched the movies or they've played this game, but they won't really have interacted with the books.
Imaginatively, they won't at all. I mean, the movies already have done that. I mean, if you had a statue that told a story, Michelangelo's David, and you made a movie out of it, it obviously wouldn't be the same experience as the statue. right? It's an entirely different medium, this and that. But we confuse, because they're so long, there's been film adaptations of story. We think that, in a way, the film experience, the film adaptation, is like the imaginative experience, when really it's a sense experience. It's an entirely different way of understanding and experiencing story. And now we're going to have these virtual reality games and such, and we're going to move farther and farther away from imagination. I'm sorry to go off on that spiel there, but it's important because of what Beth talks about in terms of imagination in one of her essays here. That it's not a sentimental thing. It's a human capacity for understanding, and we're moving farther away from it. So I'm excited that I'm a little concerned because I think that you're right that there are fewer and fewer people of that age that have read all the seven stories and really come to terms with the story as a text, and we're getting into this virtual Harry Potter, which is not the same certainly as the imaginative, immersive Harry Potter.
But how great that you're having your students read all of them during the semester. That's a lot of pages, I would say.
It is a lot of pages. But over 14 weeks, it's doable. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I suspect that there are a few who fudge occasionally, and, you know, a few of them have read it so many times, but usually the students who've read it a million times are eager to read it again.
Yeah.
Those are the students who don't care about reading it again. They'll put down anything else to read Harry Potter anyway.
Right.
And so...
I mean, people who laugh about that, Katie... Harry Potter, the seven book, which is one book, is 1,054,000 words. Mm-hmm. Okay, War and Peace is 560,000 words, and nobody balks at spending a semester going into War and Peace. And Christian scriptures, Old and New Testaments, are 770,000 words. So I mean, it's not as if there's not enough stuff to talk about for a semester and enough of a challenge.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Oh no, we never run out of things to say. That's never the problem. In fact, my last set of evaluations, that was about the only thing that anybody complained about, was that sometimes we didn't get through everything that was planned for the class. I'll have a list of things that I'll put up, and I'll say, okay, here's what I want to talk about today. And a few of the students were dissatisfied that there was so much to talk about that we didn't get to everything.
Oh, I love that. More class, please. That's what the students say.
Well, if my students listen to this, they're going to be gagging because they have to read a book a week. They're getting the whole Cormoran Strike thing. They're getting
awesome.
They're getting Nabokov. They're they're saying, how can I sign up for her class?
No, it's all good, right? So so I do have a question though for you, Beth, in terms of your specialties, Victorian British literature, and I wondered if, you know, as you made that segue to a modern British writer, J.K. Rowling, if you find that the things that you studied with Victorian literature have made any crossovers into your study of the Harry Potter stories.
Well, of course, as you know, J.K. Rowling is a huge fan of the 19th century, so there are plenty of connections. Some of them are small things, some of them are large. I mean, a small one, speaking of the casual vacancy, is that the casual vacancy is really indebted to Middlemarch, but even the you have Millicent Bulstrode, who's named after a major character in Middlemarch, so there, you know, things like that. And of course there are things like the connections between Heathcliff and Snape, and there are the orphan plots from Jane Eyre and Oliver Twist, and I always talk about those in class. And the whole Buildings Roman plot. So all of that is connected, and I'm a sucker for the epilogue. A lot of people don't like the epilogue to Harry Potter. I love it. It's familiar to me from the Victorian novel. But the most important thing for me is that my approach to Victorian literature has been historical and cultural, and the ways that Victorian novels comment on social problems, and that's also what appeals to me about the Rowling books, is the ways that she comments on human nature and on contemporary issues, as a lot of fantasy does. It's fantasy has a way of taking an imagined world and making it a commentary on the real world. One of the things that interests me the most, my approach is historical and my approach is feminist. And so, for example, with the house elves, I know that, Katie, in your work, you apply the feminine mystique, and I think that was brilliant. I love that. I look at John Stuart Mill and the subjection of women.
Oh, yeah.
And the way he talks about that men don't just want a slave, they want a willing slave, and that's what they get in a wife. And I think in many ways that's what the house elf is. Mm. The house elf is sort of the domestic ideology of the Victorian period, and the idea that she, that the house elf, like the Victorian woman, has been so thoroughly taught that to sacrifice herself for her man and for her family is the highest of goods, that it just doesn't even occur to her that maybe her situation is not the ideal one.
That's great. So, of course, that totally resonates with me. So, absolutely. And one of the things I was interested in too, that your earlier book was about literary housekeeping, which is, I think, I don't know if you coined that phrase, but that's great, because you hear about social housekeeping, where, you know, women sort of decided their domestic role actually uniquely enabled them to kind of clean up society. And it sounds like you think that literature can serve that role too, and that you have these women using literature to try to resolve social problems, and that's something that women particularly might be focused on.
Yeah, you captured my thesis exactly. We're clearly on a similar wavelength, that the writers that I'm looking at, and Charlotte Perkins Gilman is a particularly good example, talk about the ways that women's domestic role is useful, is uniquely useful, more so in some ways than men's, for cleaning up society, that we need to raise the dust in order to clean things up that men have gotten all wrong. And so they use that metaphor in their writing, and they also then talk about the writing itself is a way of cleaning things up, or a way of mothering their readers, so to speak. And so it's both a topic of the literature and also a description of what they think that literature at its best can accomplish.
And it seems like J.K. Rowling as a part of that too.
I do. I mean, she's different in a lot of ways, but she certainly does she argues too in her commencement address and some of her interviews, that there is a social function for literature, and clearly that's a lot of what's going on. A lot of people have talked about the effect of being a reader of Harry Potter for people's sense of compassion and their lack of less social prejudice and things of that sort. And so, I'm interested in the social effects of her books, but I'm also, one of the things that interests me a lot is that she takes the role, a lot of people early on were criticizing her that the mothers in her books were just mothers, and that was very conservative. But of course, what she shows is that there is a special kind of power from mother love, and Molly Weasley turns out to be the biggest badass of them all, and Lily Potter is her love for Harry turns out to have really a sacramental quality, and that's very similar to how someone like Harriet Beecher Stowe talked about the power of motherhood too.
Boy, that's great, because I was just I wanted to break in and say this is why Lenin's favorite author was Harriet Beecher Stowe. Is that this sort of a radical, progressive, really revolutionary idea is something that you get in Uncle Tom's Cabin as a social mechanism in story. Anyway, forgive me. I just love the fact that you mentioned that. We're definitely on the same wavelength.
Rowling, obviously, from the very beginning, she's talking about simply, there are school rules. They're not supposed to be going to the forbidden section of the library, and they're not supposed to be going to the forbidden forest, and they're not supposed to be traveling around at night where the Sorcerer's Stone is hidden, and all of those things. So there are simple just school rules, and there are ministry rules. And one of the things that we begin to learn very quickly is, as we read the book, especially with, when you compare the response to Harry's doing magic outside of school in book two as opposed to book three, is that a lot of the ministry rules turn out to be really arbitrary, and they are administered in arbitrary ways and with a lot of favoritism, and there's something clearly corrupt about some of the rules. And obviously some of the rules at Hogwarts seem to be made to be broken, and you know, going into the, you know, the breaking the rule about seeing Fluffy and talking and getting the Philosopher's Stone, all of that is turns out, well, it saves people's lives, and it's one, you know, it's a really good thing to do, and it's, they stop Voldemort. But it's deeper than that, because what I began to see as I studied things more and more is that the kinds of rules that are deeper, the customs, the norms of wizarding society are also questionable. You know, begin to realize that at first the wizarding world seems like it's so much better than anything that the Dursleys are having, and you know, we love the wizarding world so much more. But as we begin to see more and more of it, we learn about all of the prejudices and the fear of the other, and what seemed kind of cute that wizards think that muggles are inferior. And it's just sort of a reversal of the way that the Dursleys look at wizards. As we look at it more and more, we realize, oh, you know, they've got this prejudice against the muggle-born wizards, and they call them bad names. And that, you know, even a family as nice as the Weasleys, as fundamentally good as the Weasley family, they have, you know, Mrs. Weasley would like to have a house elf. And the Weasleys are inclined to distrust goblins, and Ron has grown up thinking that all giants are dangerous, and for a while, even though he knows and loves Hagrid, he distrusts Hagrid, and he certainly responds initially very badly when he finds out that Lupin is a werewolf. And so these assumptions, they're not exactly rules, but they are norms, they're mores, they're things that are so accepted that they're almost like rules. And a lot of what Rowling is asking her readers to do is to challenge those and to ask ourselves, you know, is the way that things are done and our ideas about what is good, what is bad, who is good, who is acceptable, how much are those legitimate? And how much do we need to challenge those? And some of them, of course, make sense, but a lot of it is corrupt, and we have to call it into question. We have to break those taboos. We have to break those rules and approach things in a fresh way.
One of the things that you tie into these norms or mores, as you mentioned, is the concept of dirt or filth. When did you notice that dirt, dirty objects, or maybe concepts of being contaminated by dirt, obviously like mudbloods, when did you notice that that dirt was playing an important role in the wizarding world, and what is J.K. Rowling trying to tell us about that?
Well, what happened was that I had been thinking almost from the very beginning, in fact I was talking about it a little bit with my students the very first class I taught, about sort of as a model, how do you come up with a topic? Well, here's a topic that interests me. Here's how I would find quotations and things to back up my arguments. So I've been thinking all along about writing an article about housekeeping in the series and the domestic in the series. And when I finally got around to saying, okay, it's time to start working on this chapter, I thought, well, okay, if you're going to be thinking about housekeeping, you need to think a little bit about the things that you're cleaning up. And so, okay, I was going to do a little bit about dirt and try to work that in. And about the same time I was gearing up to write the chapter, I also started hearing stories on NPR about studies, or seeing them online, studies about disgust and the fact that people who have a really strong disgust response to you know, things like blood or rats or, you know, just a lot of things, feces, the kinds of things that people do respond with disgust to.
Right.
But people who respond more intensely tend to have more conservative political ideas. And people who have a really strong disgust response, obviously it's not everybody, I don't want to generalize, but a lot of times people who are very easily disgusted are more likely to be homophobic, they're more likely to be xenophobic, to be afraid of people from other countries, other religions, and things like that. And so the things just sort of came together. And, you know, the first thing, of course, that occurred to me was the term filthy mudblood. Mm-hmm. And the response that people had to that idea. And then I started looking. I have electronic copies of the books, and I did a search, and I started looking for words like dirt and mud and things like disgust and just a whole series of synonyms. And I found hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. Hmm. And I was like, oh, I'll find a few things. Oh, my goodness. It's everywhere. It's just constant. And partly, the magical world turns out to be a little bit grubby. But one of the things I realized is that it starts out really early. From the very beginning, though she gets worse as the series goes on, Petunia is this really obsessive housewife, to the point of being really obsessive-compulsive about her cleaning. On the other hand, one of the very first things we see about Harry is that his hair is untidy. Uh-huh. And one of the first things we see about Hagrid is he tells the story of the death of Harry's parents and he pulls out a really dirty handkerchief. One of the first things we see about Ron is he has a smudge of dirt on his nose. So the Dursleys, with all their cleanliness, seem just really cold, whereas all of the people we like turn out to be kind of dirty. In the Burrow, once we see that, it's, you know, they're boots all over the place, and it's kind of a mess. It's not dirty, but it's messy and seems lovable and lived in. And so Rowling starts out just sort of creating this unexpected reversal of what we usually think about dirt. And then as the series goes on, you begin to see, okay, there are some places that really do fit in. Like the Gaunt's house, that's filthy and it's a really horrible place. Or a Sirius Black's house, number 12, grim old place, that's absolutely, it's the filthiest place you can imagine. And, you know, it's a place where there isn't very much love. So, whereas the Burrow, which is kind of a mess, Molly Weasley's good at keeping things clean. She's, you know, she's always doing laundry and things, and it's a part of her expression of love. So it turns out that you really can't just say, oh, clean is bad, dirt is good. But you also have to say, oh, the sort of automatic response we have, that a word like filthy means bad. Well, it turns out that people who are throwing that word around a lot, like Draco Malfoy, or like the Death Eaters in general, Voldemort, etc., that those people are hateful. And what they are considering filthy and dirty is often pretty much identical to who they are. I mean, obviously, someone like Hermione or someone like Harry, you know, he's a half-blood, she's a mudblood, but they are in every real way indistinguishable from any other wizard. And so some of that idea about what is dirty or filthy or disgusting turns out to be purely socially defined, which fits in with the research that social scientists and biologists have done, that, well, you know, we know that little babies will put anything into their mouths. It's only as they grow a little older that they begin to learn, oh, no, that's nasty, that's disgusting, you don't eat that, you don't touch that.
I want to push back on that a little bit. Like, okay. I've had seven kids. I've seen them put plenty of stuff in their mouth. because a lot of social psychologists, people like Jonathan Haidt, say that these categories you're talking about are largely genetic, and that this purity cleanliness thing is largely because conservative people have a sanctity concern, a moral concern that progressive people don't have so much of, that progressive people have a relatively narrow moral focus on fairness and cheating, as opposed to the three of the five other concerns that conservatives have in a relatively equal balance. This is all in the righteous mind. But what I love about your work is that you're right on top of the complexity. Like this dirt issue, snakes are considered to be the grossest, nastiest thing, and yet snakes are the symbol of these people that, I mean, they embrace it. It's in the dark markets. It's the Slytherin house. You know, they're all about snakes. And then the rule breaker thing, as you were talking about it, you know, who's the biggest rule breaker in the series? The Dark Lord is the great rule breaker. He's upsetting the entire social order. The conservatives in the book, in terms of conserving the accepted status quo, you know, politically, socially, in terms of morality, is Dumbledore. I mean, he's trying to keep the statute of secrecy. He's trying to keep the all these things that have been what the norm is, and the Dark Lord is trying to innovate politically. He's a revolutionary.
Right, and so, I love that, because one of the things that Beth, you point out is that Voldemort is quite creative and innovative, and he's one of the few wizards that we see, you know, creating new spells and, you know, doing things that are, although there are other ones who do that too. I mean, the Weasley twins I think of too on this, but that when Voldemort is doing that as an innovation, that then he does become, you know, challenging to the order that exists in that way of innovation. I think I teach British history, and when we talk about the 17th century, innovation is like a dirty word to them, because their idea is that ancient liberties, well, they were in the past, and so we have to preserve those, and anything innovative can be tyrannical. And it seems kind of like Voldemort does, you know, embrace that these innovations might themselves prove tyrannical. About creativity and invention, you argue that the most genuinely creative characters in the series are typically the rule breakers, not just the mischievous Weasley twins, but particularly Death Eaters and Voldemort. I also think of Snape in this way, right? You talk about Sectum Sempra in the chemistry book. What's so creative about these bad guys, and why don't the more heroic characters tend to demonstrate creativity and inventiveness?
Well, a lot of what I found in the chapter is that the mischief makers and the evil characters are more likely to sort of think outside the box, or as people who study creativity say, they call them divergent thinkers. And one of the problems is that Hogwarts, and there's some other people have worked on this who've argued that it teaches how to do accepted spells rather than to create new ones. Mm-hmm. And so wizard culture, I mean, this isn't exactly something that's in my chapter, but one of the things I've been thinking about is that wizard culture has been really for centuries in a state of sort of constant siege. They're worried about the other. They're worried about maintaining the status quo in the face of all these threats. And now, of course, they've got Voldemort. So some of it is simply that they just don't have the time and the energy for creative thinking. Now, you might think they have these problems to solve, they would use them. But my thinking about this is somewhat evolving, in that what I observed in that, and that is the first paper that I wrote about the series, was that I was just sort of surprised that Rowling herself, although she's so creative, the people who she talks about specifically as being creative, I mean, you've got Voldemort, who basically he talks about creating Horcruxes. He's about the only person who uses the word create. And you have someone like Dolores Umbridge, who comes up with this just really horrifying form of punishment. It's very creative, and she spends a lot of time creating rules. That's one of the things she does, is making up brand new rules and brand new titles for herself. And meanwhile, somebody like Hermione, who's very smart, doesn't spend all that much time actually creating anything. She's just learning how to do things right. And so part of what I saw was just sort of this contradiction, and that sort of seeing that Rowling is almost on, she is more like, and in some bizarre ways more sympathetic to Voldemort than she is to someone like Harry or Ron, who are not very creative. I think one of the things that I've begun to think of is that the kind of creativity or the kind of imagination that Harry and Ron have maybe is more divergent than I was giving it credit for. the fact that Harry is able to imagine how other people are feeling, that he's able to get inside people's heads. So in the scene where he's in the Pensieve and he sees the trial of Barty Crouch Jr., and he's learned about what's happened to Neville's parents, and he's able to imagine, to empathize with Neville, but he's also able to empathize and imagine how young Barty is feeling, how he's being rejected by his father, how he is going to be sent to Azkaban. And the fact that he is able to have that imaginative leap, that is very close to what Rowling talks about in her Harvard address, where she says that that we have the way we can make change is that we can imagine better. Uh-huh. And so the fact that Harry and Hermione, for all of her rule-boundness, is able to step outside wizard culture and say, wait a minute, the way that house elves are being treated, the way that goblins are being treated, the way that dragons are being treated is not quite right, and that needs to change. That's not the same kind of creativity as inventing something or as painting a picture or creating music, but it is a kind of creative and rule-breaking thinking. And so I guess I feel that it's, as with most of the series, there's a complexity there. And it's, I don't want to just say, oh, okay, they're not that creative. The only creative people are the rule breakers. Though it does say something about the nature of creativity, is that you do have to do things differently than the way that everybody does them. Otherwise, what's creative there, right?
Uh-huh. I think that Rowling's creativity here, I mean, really, again, Beth, you're focusing on the complexity and the, you know, no cardboard cutout answers to this thing is invaluable. But you say in your summary that the creative process gets short shrift in the Harry Potter series, at least in regard to the fine arts. And I think there what we're missing is that a function of Rowling being a writer about texts and our experience within the texts is really the creativity she's after. She's not really showing you in the thing, you know, as a parodist, a person who writes, you know, parodies of her favorite genres, it is her work that is innovative and creative.
Right.
And it demands, as do the Hogwarts paintings, that readers engage with them to enter into the world behind the surface. So she's fostering mm-hmm. this creative art of reading and understanding story in her reader, not writing a didactic lesson about the plastic, poetic, or musical arts. You know, hence all the all the embedded text we have in the story, from most especially the prophecy and narrative misdirection, you know, the Dark Lord, you know, manipulating Harry through the images in his head, you know, all these things are inside a text whose key feature and challenge to the reader is narrative misdirection. He's teaching mm-hmm. us to be creative and engaged readers, and yet you're right, the creative process on the surface of the story doesn't get that much attention. You know,
there's not a lot of meta in that sense. That she, you know, you sometimes, obviously, you get many books that are, you know, portrait of the artist, and you really see that. But that's clearly not what she's after at all. That's not her point. She, as you say, she's trying to get her readers to engage in creative thinking.
And I just want to point out, that this is pretty much our exact conversation from when we were talking about having students read in class and read the Harry Potter books as opposed to engaging with purely the movies or like a virtual reality forum.
Okay.
So I'm just going to draw that back in. Yeah, and you know, one of the things that's been interesting, at the Southwest Popular and American Culture Conference, where they have a Harry Potter section, I heard a talk last year about how, you know, they do lack, for example, like popular music, and you mentioned that as well, that there's not a lot of like really mm-hmm. creative music. We don't hear much from the Weird Sisters. You've got the Sorting Hat, there's Celestina Warbeck, but what real like musical artistry is there? And that fans have actually been filling in the gap. So fans do like wizard rock, and you know,
right.
they're trying to fill in the playlist for what the kids might be listening to. And so I find that kind of interesting, right, that this space that she hasn't really filled. Maybe other people are coming in to
Yeah, I
fill
think
that.
so. I think so. And I think that is part of the interesting side of Harry Potter fandom, is the way that they create. The creativity seems to be coming from the fans rather than from creative characters within the series.
And I wonder too, now this is just this is a wild idea. As we were talking about it, I haven't thought about it at all, but I wonder if, you know, J.K. Rowling is the creator of her world, and she creates the rules of her world, and I wonder if she likes the people, you know, if our heroes are less likely to be rule breakers, despite the Weasleys are fun, we enjoy them, but they're less likely to be rule breakers like Hermione, because they're going along with J.K. Rowling's version, her understanding of how the world is supposed to work, and they're not, you know, taking it in a different direction, which is really what Voldemort and the Death Eaters are doing. I don't know. I've sort of made myself a little confused in saying that, but I don't know if you see what I mean there.
I do see what you mean, and I think there is truth in that. And she certainly, and I think it's really important, is that she sets up the rules of her world, and, you know, that there's, you know, Grop's conservation of energy, whatever it's called, that you know, you can't create something out of nothing. And she has a definite, there are definite parameters. You know, death is death, for example. You can't break that rule. That's impossible to break. But I also think that, you know, Harry and Hermione and Ron are just wreaking havoc on the system. They're doing all kinds of things they're not supposed to do.
Well, that's true.
And so it's, you know,
they're rule breakers, but they're not necessarily creative, I guess.
But they're not necessarily creative, certainly in the traditional way we think of it.
And they never challenge the system head on, really, until Deathly Hallows. I mean, they're prefects. I mean, if you've been chosen as a prefect, we know that you have not pushed the boundaries too far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really interesting. So this makes me think that we should talk about one of the big taboos, which is the area of the unforgivable curses. One of the unforgivable curses that you focus on is particularly the Imperius curse, which is unforgivable, and yet, as you point out, things like Veritaserum, Obliviate, Amortensis, which is the love potion, these things that also establish a kind of mind control, these are not considered unforgivable. And so why do you think the unforgivable curse is different from that? Why does J.K. Rowling think that that's a different kind of thing?
Mad-Eye Moody, Barty Crouch Jr., that character, does say that it's a complete mind control, that you can... And when he demonstrates with the spiders, for example, he has the spider doing things that a spider couldn't do. He has Neville doing things that Neville ordinarily wouldn't be able to do. So it is a really complete overtaking of the self. And so that is, you know, that is very extreme. And yet at the same time, as you say, you know, it is kind of odd that some of these other things that also have a lot of do take a lot of control are still, you know, that those are allowed. I think part of it is that Veritas Serum is used as a tool of state control. You know, that they give it to Barty when, you know, and he confesses, and of course part of that is just useful for exposition, so we find out what happened. But it's very clear. I mean, Umbridge is going to give some to Harry when she thinks that he has broken some rules, and there's a sense that, okay, it's closely regulated, except obviously Umbridge is not following regulations, but it is a sort of a coercive state thing, and that is definitely part of Rowling's critique, is that it is being used as a form of self-incrimination, which is against American law, and is, you know, it's considered by some places actually a form of torture. But if the state's doing it in the wizarding world, that's okay. It's part of the problem with them. Obliviate, again, it's mainly used to control muggles. Not entirely, but that is seen as a way of keeping wizards safe. And it's, you know, part of the power of the ministry. Amortensis is kind of like a date rape drug.
That's beautiful. That's perfect.
And, you know, even though it's frequently used by women and we see more of that, I do think that that reflects a kind of a cultural blindness about the dangers of sexual abuse and abuse of power. And although obviously the ministry does understand the power of love, I mean, they have, you know, the room in the Department of Mysteries, it's also not, you know, it's just laughed about. I mean, people make jokes. The way, let's face it, you know, they make jokes about rape to this day. So I think that some of it is, it's social commentary that all of these types of spells or potions that go just short of the imperious curse are, you know, they're acceptable. And, you know, she really showing sort of a complexity about these problems.
So one of the things that you talk about that I think is so interesting is, of course, that Harry uses the Imperious Curse on the goblin at Gringotts in the last book. And I do find this scene very problematic, right, am I thinking about it?
Yes.
He's never caught for doing it, but actually we also, I think you pointed this out too, we don't see him even reflecting much on his use of this unforgivable curse. You know, what should we as readers be thinking about that, do you think?
Well, I hope that most readers do question that. I actually did have a student who seemed to have no problem about the Dementor's curse being used on Barty Crouch, and I was really, wait a minute, yeah, you know, this is trial with, you know, this is death sentence without trial. Yeah. I was pretty horrified. So clearly not every reader is sensitive to these things. I would hope that most readers would at least question. But I think that part of it is that it's one of those scenes where you have to ask the question, is this a case where the ends justify the means? But of course, especially the Deathly Hallows has done a lot of work calling into question that whole idea of doing things for the greater good. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? And part of what I think is going on here is that Rowling is sort of showing us the psychology of breaking ethical taboos. Because the very first time he uses the Imperious Curse, he has to be told. Griphook says, you know, is going to do something, use the Imperious Curse. And at that point he does, and he's afraid maybe it's not working because he knows that if you're going to do an unforgivable curse, you have to mean it. Second time he does it much more automatically. And then the third time he does it, it's when they're trying to get past the dragon, and you know they've had the enchantment washed away, and he shouts it out, Imperio. And he's much more comfortable with it. And so you can see the way that you break the rule once, that's uncomfortable. You do it again, it's easier. And the third time, oh, well, no big deal. So it's sort of following that. He also, it describes that there's this warm tingling feeling in his arm when it happens. It's pleasurable. There's something enjoyable about that power that he has. And I think that what it's showing us, I mean, of course, we still like Harry, but it's showing us how easy it is to break a rule and then get used to breaking a rule. And I kind of think it's like a lesson in the way that evil can take over people's lives in spite of themselves.
Boy, that's so well done inside this article. Really, this essay, I think Katie agrees with me. This makes buying Ravenclaw Chronicles, you know, worth the price of the book is this essay because of the ambiguity you bring in here. But I mean, right on this point, you know, you point out that we experience the seductive power of the Imperious Curse. My problem is we're not given any sign that Harry and company have any misgivings in having fallen to coercive magic to get what they want, just as the bad guys have done. This is a little bit like the beat up done to the Draco and company on the Hogwarts Express at the end of Goblet of Fire, where I mean they're beaten up by a gang of people, they're totally disfigured, they're thrown into cupboards, and that's all for the good. I mean, the only real rationalization of Harry's behavior is that they are at war now, so all restraints against murder, torture, coercion, they're off, right? But this, yeah. This is a failing of the book, that the characters do not reflect on what they're becoming in the battle against the Death Eaters, which is to say they're becoming the Death Eaters themselves, right? I mean, they're becoming their enemy. When I read your paper, I thought, wow, this is where Hunger Games is so much better than Harry Potter. You know, that Collins tells you flat out that war is necessary, you know, that there is yeah. an unjust situation where you have to fight, but you're going to be destroyed by the experience. That war is necessary and simultaneously the worst possible answer to any problem.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think that is a flaw, and I agree with you that the Hunger Games handles that real psychological and ethical problem more directly.
Yeah, but again, this essay that you wrote brings this up in a way that it's so wonderfully done. I mean, I'm an eye man. I'm really into the eyes of Deathly Hallows, the five big eyes there, and how that Rowling yeah. really is into an epistemological journey with the eyeballs. And you point out in here the wonderful stuff about how the eyes always go sideways and off. When the Imperius curse is that Rowling is saying this is the worst possible thing you can do to a person. That's why it's unforgivable, is that you're messing with their mind coercively. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. as bad as, in a way, that is murder.
Yeah.
And then Harry does it and begins, as you say, to become used to it and thrilled by it. And we don't get a, wow, what have I become moment.
Yeah.
Is a real, you know, it's a pogo moment. You know, we've seen the enemy and he is us. I mean, why doesn't Harry have a come to Jesus moment where he says, oh my goodness, you know, what are we doing?
Yeah, I wonder though if, I mean, I think I'm going to try to play devil's advocate. Like, maybe you could see the way that he uses the Elder Wand just to repair his own wand, right? And then is not going to use the Elder Wand himself. Maybe that does, at least elliptically, give us some indication that he doesn't really want to use that kind of coercive power. I'm just going to put that out there.
No, I think you're right that what we wind up with Harry when he says, Beth brought up the greater good issue. Harry mm-hmm. winds up saying to Aberforth, hey, that greater good thing, yeah, you can go too far. You know, you can go crazy on greater good and wind up in Grindelwald land, but the greater good and dying sacrificially in love for your friends, that's where I live. I mean, and he sort of splits the mean between a radical individualism and then a radical socialism, communism, you know, totalitarian situation. And that's where Rowling splits the mean. And I think you're right, Katie, that Harry's selflessness and his decisions in the face of great power is something that reflects that he gets that he can't continue to go down that road. Mm-hmm. So I think you're
yeah,
right.
And the fact that he obviously, even in, you know, at the very last moment, I mean, he allows Voldemort to kill him. So he could try to defend himself, but that's not the way he's operating. Obviously, the scene in Gringotts is designed because he's trying to get rid of these Horcruxes. He's trying to conquer Voldemort, and you know, it is problematic because of that sort of idea that the end justifies the means. But at least he doesn't repeat it outside of the real exigencies of that moment.
Yeah, I think that's mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. so well done. I mean,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
I'm one over. I'm one over. I'm glad I don't have to continue to bash Rowling on this point. That's great.
Let's talk about the taboos themselves. And I love that you take this cultural approach. And actually, you mention Mary Douglas, the anthropologist, mm-hmm. and purity mm-hmm. and danger. And that's informing some of the kinds of things that you're talking about. And that cultural approach, we were actually talking some about that when we were talking about Fantastic Beasts in our previous episode. And one of the things that I think the rule breaking and the taboos brings up are some of the tensions about choice And certainly the imperious curse brings that up too. And, you know, choice within a context of prophecy, right? Free will and determinism. You know, how does the rule breaking in Harry Potter relate to the central theme about choice, about free will and determinism?
Okay, well, obviously one of the most famous lines in the series is when Dumbledore says, "It is our choices, Harry, that show what we truly are, far more than our abilities." And the idea of ethical choice is absolutely central to the whole series. When Draco claims that he has no choice but to kill Dumbledore, he is living up to his name. It's a case of existential bad faith. And Dumbledore keeps saying, "No, you really do have a choice," and that's part of what is really emphasized in the series. Dumbledore explains to Harry that the prophecy did not make anything happen, and this is one of the ways that prophecy in the Harry Potter series is not the same thing as prophecy in the classical literature that Rowling studies. Like, you know, the obvious example is Oedipus the King, where there's just nothing you can do to avoid that prophecy. Doesn't matter how you try to manipulate things, you can't avoid that prophecy. What Dumbledore is saying, it's only that Voldemort made the choice to act on what he saw as the prophecy, that there are apparently tons of prophecies in the Department of Mysteries that have never come true. And so the series, I think, is very much using the ideas that, say, Milton talks about in Paradise Lost, where God says that that Adam and Eve have a choice, and it's a real choice, even though it's all predicted and all prophesied, and God, who knows everything, knows that they're going to eat of the apple. Nevertheless, in the Christian idea of things, Adam and Eve, human beings, have a choice. And part of even the fortunate fall that Milton is talking about is that they then get knowledge of good and evil. And I suppose that maybe is another way of thinking about Harry's using evil in by using the imperious curse, is that he now knows what that is. And so it's very, very important within the series that even at the end, Harry gives Voldemort a choice. We know that the way that you can make your soul whole again, even though it's painful, is to feel remorse. And he says, "Come on, Tom, feel some remorse. You still have hope." And he's laughed at. And so it's only after Harry is offered that choice to repent that the climactic moment happens and Voldemort is finally killed. So it's, I think that, you know, a lot of people, and I know, John, that this is core to what you're saying too, is that this really is a very religious book in a lot of ways, that the rap against Rowling that this is somehow endorsing Satanism and that it's not religious and all that, I think it's just the opposite. I think that the idea that we have free will and that what we choose makes all of the difference in who we become, I think that's absolutely central to what the series is about.
Now, I'm gonna take the devil's advocate position here. I don't know if I can do as well as Milton does here, playing the bad guy here, but what you're voicing here is really the accepted view that Rowling's Potter books are a full-throated celebration of free will versus destiny. And I've just finished a big literature survey for my PhD, and really the recent scholarship is kicking hard against this idea. I mean, you got Lisa Hopkins writing Harry Potter and the Narratives of Destiny. Lauren Camacci, who spoke at Chestnut Hill in her frisky, risky fire whiskey, and Charlotte Folks, Free Will and Determinism, a Compatibilist Reading. I mean, the resistance is just because despite the It's Your Choices, Harry, foregrounding, the stories turn out to be about a hero's decision to conform heroically to a prophecy destiny. You know, his only free choice is his decision to live within the story he has been given on his terms, rather than as a victim. That's a long, long way from independent agency contrasted with destiny.
Right.
I mean, he tells Aberforth, I'm not going to do the free will thing. I'm not running from the story I've been giving. I'm going to live heroically inside that story. That's not really free will. That's a long, long way from independent agency contrasted with destiny. That's not free will. That's Harry deciding that he's going to accept what historically, psychologically he's been given, and that he cannot escape. And that his action of free will, which can make all the difference, is his decision to live within that, again, heroically. This is like if I wanted to decide to live, pretend that I'm a 13th century Japanese Buddhist nun, I could probably, pretend to do that. I think only a 21st century American man would think that he could do that, right? I'd be demonstrating my being imprisoned to my historical period by trying that. But that's basically just foolishness, according to Rowling. And her world is based, and this is the a lot of the push back from the scholarship now is that the absolute center of the Department of Mysteries is the Hall of Prophecy, because in there you see there is an extra temporal reality which intrudes into the world to show that there is a if not a predetermined, then a almost certain future that's there, and that this is the greatest magic of all. And that the fact that she uses this comic figure of Trelawney as the voice of this prophecy, really the ur-text of the entire series, and that Trelawney, even when drunk, throwing out cards in Half-Blood Prince, happens to drill the fact that Dumbledore is about to take a dive off the astronomy tower. I mean, those points to the fact that there is this transcendent reality that sometimes intrudes into the world, and that's mm-hmm. not a voluntarist individual freedom position. That's a very sophisticated idea that there's a cosmology in which we play, and that we're largely given a hand by genetics, by psychology, by historical memes that we buy into because they're unexamined. It's a much more sophisticated play than it's all about your choices, Harry. Would that it were all about your choices, Harry, right?
I mean, yeah, and I think that comes through. Like, I don't think I think it would be hard to argue, actually, that everything is entirely free will. But one of the things that I think is interesting, like, there are so many prophecies. Like, Sybil Trelawney gets it right, like, once every, 10 years or something, right?
Twice, and totally unwillingly. That's the great part about Sybil. She's a total fraud.
Yeah.
And yet she's the voice of this extra transcendent reality. Hilarious.
So how do you know what is the thing that's going to come to be? That's our human condition, is that there can be prophecies and there can be things that are predetermined, and maybe we're living them out. But even within that, we're just living them out according to the choices that we, feel that we're making at the time. And so I think there is that middle position. That's actually a common position that historians say, that we're making choices, but they are constrained by the time, and our agency is constrained to some degree by the time in which we live and the possibilities that are open for us. Like you say, like what are the possibilities for our story? And there aren't maybe infinite possibilities.
I find the whole issue of free will and determinism a little bit mind-boggling in general. It's a whole philosophical study in its own right, and I'm not a philosopher. So,
all right, but the text does give you things to think about. But I think one of the things that I think you're talking about in your work are the ambiguities that J.K. Rowling leaves open for us to figure out and to debate about among ourselves. And so, so that is an area that she maybe doesn't make it entirely clear. She's got arguments on both ends, the free will, the choices part, and also the prophecy determinism part. And maybe these
conversations
are it.
I think John's point that there are prophecies that Trelawney makes in spite of herself, like just sort of drunkenly throwing out the tarot cards. The true prophecies that, something, some other voice speaking through her is one set of things, but then there's just sort of this weird stuff that she gets right I mean, even when she gets Harry's birthday wrong early on, and he says, "No, it's not
But
December."
what
Well,
a
it turns out that it is Voldemort's birthday in December. So she
That's
was right. She was sensing that other part of Harry that Harry didn't even know was there at that point.
Perfect. Even better is when Ron and Harry are making up their divinations homework, and they drill exactly what's going to happen later in the story. And so they're just throwing this stuff out, and they're like, "Oh, this is hilarious. We're having a hoot. We're laughing up our sleeve at divination." And because we're finally not, doing this entirely right-brained editing process on how we think and what we're able to perceive, we happen to perceive what happens in the future. I mean, she's Rowling is really, forgive me, a student of Nabokov, who talks entirely about the other world and its permeation of our world. And so her spirituality is entirely about the ones we love who never leave us, that they're constantly around us. He only sees it when he touches the resurrection stone, but they're there all the time. So Rowling on the surface is giving a very secular, and she's almost doing a parody of the whole Christian content. She said she thought it was obvious, but the more sophisticated, subtle, and challenging content that she gives inside the stories about, basically that those who love never leave us, and she means quite literally never leave us. They're around us, influencing us, is a dramatic take, and points to the fact that it's that the free will reflex that we have as postmoderns. It's all about us and our decisions, which is largely blind to the influences of history. Every historical period thinks that it's the end of history, and Katie and you as historians will say, "Oops, the only thing we know about us is that we're equally duped if we think we're at the end of history." That's the only thing that we're sure of, is that we're wrong if we think we're the end of history. And so the free will thing has to kick against all of those things, and that Harry, when he finally accepts, "Hey, this is my story, and I've got to walk into that forest because this is the role I've been given, and I have to play this role just right," that's heroic freedom, within the story you've accepted. That's a very Christian thing, because the Christian, by definition, is saying there's a story of redemption in Christ that permeates all of humanity, and my job is to conform to the rules of that story as I give it in my historical time and place. That's a Christian position, which is this mix, this blend, this meeting of free will and determinism, not one, not the other. And Rowling seems to find that exact place. Anyway, that's sorry, this is John speaking his PhD thesis.
No, that's great. And these are issues that, Beth, you do touch on. I mean, you talk a little bit about, you mentioned Milton before, and you talk about Milton's Paradise Lost and some of those ideas about the Satan and his army, and
Beautifully
the
done.
idea of, that Milton is of the party of Satan without knowing it. I guess William Blake says that. And those are things that really do come through. And so I just would turn our listeners to the Ravenclaw Chronicles, which is, by the way, an anthology that's edited by Corbin Fowler, and it's Cambridge Scholars Press. So if our listeners are interested in getting a copy, that's the information. But I'm sorry to say that we are actually out of time. So we're going to ask our last question. So since we have been talking about sort of forcing people to tell the truth against their will, so if you could ask one question of J.K. Rowling under the influence of Veritaserum, what would you ask her?
Use the Imperius curse. Use the Imperius curse. Sorry.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I just have so much love and admiration for J.K. Rowling. I couldn't do it. I could not
You
use any
could
of those
not do
curses
it.
on her.
Okay.
Yeah, but I did try at one point. I actually joined Twitter so I could try to tweet a question to her about the portraits and who the painters were.
Oh.
And she subsequently did put an article about that on Pottermore. I'm not 100% satisfied with her answer because I don't think she gave painters enough credit. And she basically said that, there's only so much that the painter can put in, and that the reason why the headmaster portraits are able to talk is that they basically teach the portraits. But so, you know, that was the question I would have asked her. But honestly, I have become, and I know I'm supposed to be drawing things to a close, but I'm going to open a new can of worms. I have become increasingly skeptical of Rowling's answers to these questions, especially she's gotten further away from having composed the seven books, you know, the
You're
first seven.
singing John's song there, Beth.
Boy, dear.
He's in agreement with you.
Oh, really? That's
Oh, yeah.
interesting.
We disagree on a lot, Beth, but boy, I tell you, that Rowling, she's doing a William Faulkner here. She's losing touch with her thing, and you know, it's getting to the point now where you almost want to ignore her when she talks about her story.
And I think
Yeah.
sometimes she's intentionally steering you in the wrong way. Like we were talking about that with
Could
maybe
be.
Fantastic Beasts or Cormoran Strike. She's trying to be cagey a little bit, maybe.
Always, Katie, you're the kind interpreter
I
of, you know,
know.
Rolling Sticks. We make a perfect balance. I'll be the outrageous, what is she doing now? And you can say that, John, she's trying to help us.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I did want to say, just because you brought up the issue of the portraits, Beth, that there is a good book that a good chapter in a book that is about the. It's called "More Than Moving Images: The Visual Culture of Harry Potter" by Talanda Henderson and Amy von Lentil. That's in "From Here to Hogwarts," and I just put that up there
Wow.
as a. Article that is talking about the portraits, and it actually touches on some of what we said in terms of the, you know, the screens, the fact that we're interested in screens, and I think part of the argument is that it's less the portraiture than it is sort of mimicking our, you know, our kind of computer screen-oriented realm. So I will just put that out there as something to look at for
No,
that.
I'm. Thank you. Thank you. I always like to find new things on these topics and bounce my ideas off other people's ideas. So thank you very much for that.
And I did think you know, there were so many things that your work has brought up that we do not have a chance to talk about. So once again, we look forward to, with great anticipation, I think, the book that you're writing on rule breaking. Mischief Managed is the perfect name for that, by the way. What a great title. Beth, John, are either of you going to be attending the Southwest Popular and American Culture Conference in Albuquerque this year to talk about your ideas?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I'm going to be there,
Yes.
and I'll be presenting on the Nabokov things I've been talking about here today. And Beth, are you going to be there?
Yes, yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing your talk. I'm talking about Ron Weasley. My title is In Defense of Ron Weasley, and I am trying to make the case that, you know, Ron, who's getting more and more criticism, maybe is more heroic than we give him credit for, in spite of
Absolutely.
all of his problems.
You know, gosh, Beth, we're more. I think the movies have done everything to destroy Ron's legacy.
I
He's such a
know. Yeah.
goof in the films.
I
But
like
really,
Rupert Grint, but I agree. I don't agree with the interpretation of his character that he gets in the films.
I want to say just two quick things about Southwest Popular American Culture Conference is that it's sort of the West Coast version of Chestnut Hill, and we've just gotten word that Chestnut Hill in outside Philadelphia, that the annual Harry Potter conference there is going to be 2 days now, and so really we have if people should start penciling in October 19th and 20th for the Friday and Saturday Chestnut Hill conference. And I hope to see everybody at the
In
at South.
Albuquerque,
That's right,
right.
in Albuquerque.
They've got a
Woo!
Harry Potter section, and you go to that conference, and it's in Albuquerque, and it's Harry Potter sessions, one right after the other. It is wonderful. It's really just a great arena for talking about our favorite subject, Harry Potter. Let me conclude just by saying thank you so much to Dr. Beth Sutton Ramspeck for sharing your ideas with us. It has been delightful to have
Well,
this conversation.
thank you so much for having me. I've had a great time.
Well, I want to just I want to second that, Katie, and say that Dr. Sutton Ramspeck is an important new voice, and Harry Potter fans are going to be hearing from her and benefiting from this book, I hope, for years to come. This is an exciting event.
Yeah,
Thank you
for
for joining
sure.
us.
And I really like what you said, John, too, about how this is reflective of kind of a new age in Potter scholarship that is recognizing some of the complexities, ambiguities, internal contradictions, and so on that we're seeing in the books as we take a deeper look. And that I think that's one of the things that keeps us coming back, too. And thanks to you, of course, John, for being our continuing guest expert.
I love it when I get thanked for doing something that I would pay to do, but thank you. You're welcome, Katie.
I have such fun having these conversations. And I'd also like to give a big thank you to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Emma Woo! Nicholson works wonders
for
us. she is wonderful, and we could not do this without you, Emma. As always, we also want to express our deep appreciation to our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site. And I want to give a special shout out to our liaison with MuggleNet, Amy Hogan, who always does such a great job for us. Now, dear listeners, we are so happy that you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or a question. Let us know what you're interested in hearing more about. You can contact us at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com or on Twitter at readwriteroll. That's readwriteroll, readwriteroll on Twitter. And with that, I will leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not so humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll use our words to make some magic.